From WBUR Boston, I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tracy Kidder goes back 40 years to remember his struggle on the sidelines of the Vietnam War in his new memoir, My Detachment. This hour, On Point, Tracy Kidder's coming-of-age story during the Vietnam War. But first, we begin in Washington. President Bush just wrapped up what was billed as a major speech on Iraq and the larger fight against terrorism.
It is courage that liberated more than 50 million people. It is courage that keeps an untiring vigil against the enemies of a rising democracy. And it is courage in the cause of freedom that once again will destroy the enemies of freedom.
Mike Allen is White House correspondent for Time magazine and joins me now. Hello, Mike.
Good morning.
Why did the president give this speech now?
Well, this turned out to be one of possibly the most important speeches of the year, which I frankly didn't realize as I headed over to the Ronald Reagan Center this morning. You might think of this as an insurance speech. The president knows that there's a lot of tough times and perhaps bad news ahead, especially heading into the October 15th referendum on the Constitution. So the idea here was to frame what he's doing in a bigger context, to attach himself to other fights. So Ivanov recently heard the president compare the war on terror to the Cold War. But today he said, like the ideology of communism, our enemy is dismissive of free peoples. And he talked about practically every terror attack that there's been around the world and linked it to what's happening in Iraq. This speech originally was going to be given on the anniversary of September 11th a month ago because of Katrina. It was put off. And so he made similar points today, flashing back to what happened on September 11th. Recalling the time, he talked about in the United States, a great city covered in ashes and passengers who spent their final hours on Earth fighting the enemy. So this was one of those speeches by the president that has lines in it that will be quoted again and again.
Do you think he accomplished what he set out to accomplish?
Well, here's the problem. The points he was making were so at conflict with the images that your listeners and that his audiences are seeing coming out of Iraq. Now, he made the point that he says progress isn't easy, but it's steady. And he said that people who have a pessimistic view are underestimating the accomplishments of the Iraqi people, which is a very interesting way to cast it, almost as if bad news about his war policy becomes sort of blame the victim. But anyway, in the front row, you had the new brand new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, and behind him, you had sort of a classic scene for the president, the 13 American flags behind him. He spoke, the forum where he spoke was a bipartisan group, the National Endowment for the Democracy, and sort of to prove the bipartisanship, the president wasn't in the room yet, but to start things off, the former House Democratic leader, Richard Gephardt, spoke, and he used one of the president's signature lines unintentionally, I'm sure, when he said that democracy is on the march.
And I'm sure, as you said, Mike, we'll be hearing more analysis today on NPR. Mike Allen is White House correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. Thanks so much. There was not one war story of Vietnam. There were many, and many, as many wars as men. America is full of them, the things they carried. Platoon, Apocalypse Now. Most tales of the war involve the crash and horror of bombs, dramatic bloodshed, the whizzing of bullets and screams of those hit. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder has written a quieter story, one that speaks to the majority of men who did not serve on the front lines, but on the sidelines of the Vietnam War. It is a memoir, a turn inward, from a writer who is best known for thoughtfully and carefully looking outward at the people who surround him. This hour, On Point, writer Tracy Kidder and his own war in Vietnam. You can join the conversation. Have the quieter stories of Vietnam been eclipsed by dramatic tales of combat and heroes often associated with the war? What was your experience in Vietnam? Did you, like Tracy Kidder, come of age there? We're at 1-800-424-8255. That's 1-800-423-423-TALK. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is the award-winning writer Tracy Kidder. His memoir is called My Detachment. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why did you turn the focus on yourself after such a string of wonderful, six books, I believe, at least six main books that are full of awards, have won you all kinds of awards? Why did you focus on yourself in this book?
Well, actually, I started this a long time ago, about 20 years ago. And I was a junior officer in Vietnam. I had dubious command of a detachment of eight enlisted men involved in something called communications intelligence. When I started writing it, I put the title on My Detachment, and of course I meant it to be ambiguous. But I found myself completely unable to live up to the psychological implications of that title. I wrote this, I began writing this in a self-flagellating tone as if to assert that that young man I was writing about and I no longer had anything in common, or maybe never had anything in common. I'm not sure why I started it. You know, it seemed like an interesting story. And then I put it aside for a long, long time. Picked it up again, I don't know, seven or eight years ago, and sort of worked on it off and on. And finally it was done, and my publisher, Random House, didn't bring it out for a while because I had another book coming out.
And so it sat?
And so it sat a little while, yeah.
Was that good?
Not for too long.
Was that good for it to sit?
I don't know. I mean, we have a war going now. I suppose some people might think it's a good time to bring out a book about another war, but we always seem to have a war going in this country. So I don't know.
Well, when speaking of that, as the story begins in My Detachment, you really were not very aware of that war. You mentioned stopping in a store in your hometown, Oyster Bay, and learning from the shop owner that Oyster Bay had lost a young man in Vietnam.
Its first boy, yeah. This haberdasher, a lovely man. I think he's probably dead now, but I stopped in at the store, and he seemed very solemn. He wasn't usually very solemn, and he leaned on a pile of chinos and said, I lost our first boy. He was a good-looking boy, too, 31 leg, 34 waist. And I remember being amused, although not trying not to show it. And but that was that was really the almost not the full extent, but most of what I'd heard about the war. I think when I joined up, it was a 1-year ROTC program, and I had a friend who said that, you know, when you left college, you had to go in the military anyway, and it was better to be an officer than not. I think he was certainly wrong on one count and probably wrong on both. But I didn't know that then. The civil rights movement was in full swing, and a lot of the civil rights leaders up until a certain point were keeping a pretty discreet silence on the war because of the war on poverty, which was also going on. I think one of the tragic casualties of the war in Vietnam. But I went off to basic training, and when I came back to college, to Harvard, in the fall of 66, there was no missing the fact that there was a war in Vietnam, and everyone was pretty, I mean, the campus was all roiled up over it.
But you were a very unlikely person to join ROTC.
Yeah,
were
I
you?
Was.
I mean, what were your
I think I was, although, you know, when I think back, there were some people in ROTC then, some of the founders of National Lampoon, who were in it and managed to get out somehow before they finished college. So, you know, things changed rather suddenly in the 60s. But I was unlikely. Yeah, I came from a privileged background, and there were other people from privileged backgrounds who fought in Vietnam. But by and large, it was a war that was fought by the working class and the poor in America.
So what was in your mind when you joined up?
Well, partly, you know, my father's stories of World War II, it seemed like what a young man did, a sort of rite of passage. And I'd also read my Hemingway and taken it to heart, you know. Even though I think you could imagine that Hemingway's books like A Farewell to Arms or some of his great short stories like In Another Country or Away You'll Never Be or anti-war books, they're, you know, a lot of war fiction somehow, and a lot of war movies somehow manages to deplore and to romanticize at the same time, it seems to me. Anyway, I fancied it was something I thought would be nice to... I think deep down, the idea of being a warrior or something was a pleasant idea to me. Not the fact of being one, but being able to say that I had been one. I think that tendency of youth to imagine itself relishing danger and adventure, yearning for distinction, dreaming of making a sacrifice in a noble cause, and of course the tendency of youth to imagine coming out of everything unscathed. I think these are sort of ideas that are in the air in America, certainly. And I also think it's part. Yeah, sorry.
Don't be sorry. Yes. Did those ideas and that sense of attachment to being a hero, did that stay with you during training, during your early days in the Army?
No, I lost it rather quickly. I don't think that I ever was really cut out to be a warrior. I know I wasn't really. I think it was already a romantic idea. The distinction maybe this doesn't make any sense, but between actually being a warrior and being someone who could say he had been a warrior, it was the latter that I was mostly interested in. But when I got to basic training and suddenly got off this bus and suddenly these men in smoky bear hats were speaking very rudely to me, I was kind of appalled. And I didn't much like it right from the start, I have to say.
And we will pick up the story. We're talking this hour to writer Tracy Kidder about his new memoir, My Detachment, his coming-of-age story set against the chaos of Vietnam War. Does Tracy Kidder speak for you? In this quieter view of Vietnam, you can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour to writer Tracy Kidder about his new memoir, My Detachment, his coming-of-age story set against the chaos of Vietnam. Does Tracy Kidder speak for you? This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Tracy Kidder is the author of several prize-winning books, The Soul of a New Machine and Mountains Beyond Mountains. His new book, My Detachment, has America assumed there is only one story of Vietnam, the story of the soldier in combat? Does Tracy Kidder's book of A Man on the Sidelines speak to you? You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tracy, I would really like for our listeners to hear something of the tone of the book. And sure. I'd also like to get them into what you were up against when you got to Vietnam. You didn't expect, at first you had the impression that you were going to serve out the war in Arlington, Virginia.
Yes.
But then you were told, no, you're going to Nam.
You're going to Vietnam. And I remember saying, you're kidding. But sure enough, I went, I didn't know really what to expect. I eventually was told to take over this 8-man detachment, which was in an infantry brigade base camp. I was told to clean up the detachment. In Vietnam, we in my unit anyway, people were always coming and going. We all served for a year, but none of us arrived at the same time, and none of us left at the same time. So when I first got there, I think I had mostly men who had been there for quite a while, and I think they were feeling a little tired of it and wanted to go home and a little disaffected. And the lieutenant who preceded me, I think, was also sort of disaffected. In any case, I was told, clean up that detachment. And I made my first halting and bumbling moves to do that.
And then, one of the most difficult characters was a guy named Pancho.
Pancho. That was his nickname, Pancho. Yeah, difficult, although really engaging. I mean, a guy whose memory I treasure, actually. But let me read you about how one of my first encounters with him, if I may.
Please.
All right. A mortar round went overhead. In the silence that followed, I heard a banging at my screen door. I looked up and saw Pancho saunter in. I was in my underwear. He was fully dressed, still wearing his sunglasses. Hi, I said, brushing away the mosquito net. I swung my legs over the side of the cot. Can I help you? He sat down on my footlocker and said very calmly, Lieutenant, you know what a lifer is? You know what a life in beg and puke is, Lieutenant?
What?
He went right on. It's a flat dick who lifes and begs and pukes all over EM scum, Lieutenant. Ain't like a man, Lieutenant. The Army had films and pamphlets to instruct a soldier in all the activities of daily living. and I had gone to training camps for over a year and learned to avoid venereal disease and march and make my bed and fire weapons, but I had never received a single instruction in how to handle troops. I remembered how, during her first year of teaching high school, my mother would come home almost every day in tears. The Army should have sent me to an inner-city high school for 6 months and let me try to keep order in the cafeteria. As it was, I had an idea that, being an officer, I would be obeyed. I didn't know exactly what this short kid in dark glasses was talking about, but I could tell it was impertinent, and I shouldn't put up with it. I said, "Now wait a minute, Specialist." Pancho said, "We don't like some of the things you're doing around here, Lieutenant." "Well, that's too bad," I said. "We can shoot you any time we want, Lieutenant," he said. "Oh, yeah?" "Yeah, Lieutenant, we can." "I'll shoot you first," I said to him, but under my breath and after he'd gone, and I was sitting on my cot under a bare light bulb staring out toward the dark. The light reached only a few yards beyond my rusty screen walls. I couldn't see out, but anyone could stand in the patch of tall grass near my hooch and see my lighted silhouette.
Were you pretty depressed at that point?
I was pretty depressed. You know, I wasn't as afraid as I probably should have been. I was upset because it was pretty clear that my men didn't think too highly of me, and that was part of what I was going to try to accomplish, was to be beloved by my men.
There was actually one tiny thing in the reading that we should have set up first, because you went right past it when Pancho talks about pukes all over EM scum.
Oh, I'm sorry. Enlisted men. EM stands for EM. It stands for enlisted men.
Right, and that was real important to you.
It was important to me. I was really conflicted about this war. I mean, I was very young, and I was at that stage in life. I can't speak for anybody else, but you know, where I was trying on different costumes to find out who I was, I think, and a lot of my friends were very strongly against the war back home, including a couple of older mentors whose opinions I really valued. On the other hand, here I was, and you know, it was a kind of split consciousness. But I had resolved that the one thing I would do is I would be a good commander and put my men's interests, you know, right up at the top of everything. And I was obviously failing pretty miserably at that at the beginning.
But you hadn't been at it very long then.
I hadn't been at it long at all. I was in that period of life where I was very impatient. I wanted to become what I was going to become before I had even figured out who I wanted to become. You know, in any case, Pancho and I got along pretty well after that. I think as the months went on, I realized that he had actually done me a favor and given me an interesting warning. And besides, he'd defined a bunch of terms for me that I'd never heard before, like EM scum. I don't think I ever gave him a direct order after that. We would discuss things, and usually he would be reasonable about things. He wasn't one of those people whom you know, weakness incites to further violence. He just had been in the Army a long time, and he wanted to be left alone as much as possible. And you know, I was very touched that, and I write about this at the end of my book, that he actually came back to see me many, many years later.
Yeah, he really wanted to keep in touch. Let's hear from Melvin, who's calling from Panama City, Florida. Hello, Melvin.
Yes, good morning. I didn't quite understand what years you were in Vietnam, but I was there in 70, 71.
Oh, boy.
And it's funny, my whole life is based on those 70, 71. Mm-hmm. When I was there, the drug problem was really bad. And you know, I got involved in it, and I realized that before I went to Vietnam, I had never had anything to do with drugs. I'd never smoked marijuana. I'd never done any of it. But once I got there, it just, you know, I fell right in. And I was a computer repairman.
I was there from June of 68 to June of 69, and there were a lot of drugs around. There was a little town that my men called Nook Mau nearby, and they, which produced something called Nook Mau 100s, or joints, marijuana, cigarettes, big ones that came prepackaged in cellophane. I had a sergeant, though, a really wonderful guy whom the men obeyed. He had tremendous authority, another person whose memory I really treasure. And frankly, he didn't believe in drugs. He believed in beer. But so far as I know, my men never got involved with with narcotics, although they were everywhere around us. And I think it was because of him that they didn't. There was, however, a great deal of drinking going on.
A great deal of drinking. Tell us
a great deal.
Tell
of
us
drinking.
Something about some of that. And how, and did you drink with your enlisted men? And how
Oh yes. I mean, that was part of what a good commander ought to do, right? No, I was alone largely most of the time with my men. Yes, we drank a lot. We drank. Try not to drink while on duty, but I suppose that probably happened too.
Weren't we always on duty?
I guess that's right. We were always on duty, so we were drinking on duty. I had one man who was really, I think, really had a tremendous problem, and I do remember one night when he got really drunk and decided he was going to go and fire his grenade launcher at the prisoner of war cage. But my sergeant went out into the night and stopped him and brought him back. It was,
Melvin, thank you for the call. You mentioned that's something a good commander is supposed to do, isn't it? How did you start figuring out? I know you were kidding then, but how did you start figuring out what a good commander is supposed to do?
I'm not sure that I ever did. I'm not tremendously proud of anything I did in Vietnam, but I do think that, as time went on, I got more used to being there, and I got more used to the ins and outs of Army life, and I did find ways to stick up for my men, although in the face of real of field grade officers, I sometimes crumbled. I'm really ashamed of. There was a time I had a fairly brief time where I think I was really quite popular with the soldiers. Do you want me to read you something from that?
Yeah, there was a time. It seemed to me sort of the high point of the way your men looked at you.
Yeah, I'll read you just a little bit of that. This comes rather late in the story. A few days later, on a routine trip to Chu Lai in the truck, just Schultze and me in the cab, we passed an MP on Highway 1. An MP is a military policeman. "Hey, you, put on your helmet," the MP yelled at Schultze. Disciplinary orders from on high all seemed bizarre to me by then, pure malevolence towards soldiers. "Stop the truck, Schultze." I put on my helmet and jumped out the door. I strode toward the MP, a young enlisted man. I must have looked fierce because he came to attention. "If you could see that my driver wasn't wearing his helmet, you could see that I'm an officer and you should have saluted me," I said. "Yes, sir," he saluted. I saluted back, that crisp salute in which the flattened right hand is taken away from the forehead with a quick turn of the wrist. Schultze was grinning all the way to Chu Lai. "I guess you chewed his ass. I guess he..." At dawn, a few days later, I trudged up the hill with my toilet kit on the path through tall grass. One night, not long before, my men had gone to Chu Lai to see the new John Wayne movie about our war, The Green Berets. They had told me that the hundreds of GIs who were watching in a grandstand outdoors all started hooting and booing and hissing when the movie showed a scene of ocean and the sun setting over it. I mounted the stoop of the operations hooch and paused a moment, looking toward the sunrise over the sea. Then I looked down at the table where I shaved. The gray basin was there as usual, but someone had already filled it with water. The commo op on duty came to the doorway. "I heated it up for you, Lieutenant, on the hot plate. Hey, thanks." I understood the message. I was getting a lot of credit for a couple of small acts in defense of my men. Later on that day, I was alone in operations with Rose, the commo op. You could always count on him not to keep a secret. "You know what the guys called you?" he asked me. I made a face. I thought, here we go again. "Cassius," he said. "You know, like Cassius Clay." I didn't let him see me smile.
It's Tracy Kidder reading from his memoir, My Detachment. Cassius Clay being
would be Muhammad Ali.
But this was after he had refused to be drafted, correct?
Yeah, yes.
So he was sort of an anti-war hero.
Yes, he was. There were a number of them. People who actually sacrificed something in order to protest the war. I respected them. I still do.
Let's hear from Jack. Jack is calling from Buffalo, New York. And first, let me say, you can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm really appreciating this program because Well, your guest totally speaks for me. I was in Vietnam. I was in the buildup, actually. I went in 1965, 66, which shows you how long that went on. I think the fall of Saigon was in 76. And, yeah, this was totally my experience. I was also a lieutenant. I was a platoon leader. And it was a defining experience in my life for, you know, decades following that.
In what way did it define you?
When I went into Vietnam, I was a young Kennedy Democrat. You know, ask not, you know, ask what you do for your country. I believed in my country. I believed in my leaders. I believed I was going off on to accomplish something useful. And essentially, I ended up having to question all of that. And matter of fact, not just question that, but pretty much question everything that I'd ever been taught or told by anybody I had trusted or believed. And it also meant that I then had to change an awful lot of things that I believed. It's probably easy to say it made me a whole lot more cynical. It certainly made me a whole lot more questioning and certainly defined how I lived my life following that.
That's very interesting. Skeptical, not cynical, right?
Yeah. I'm no more trusting.
Right.
I felt I was lied. I had been, after the experience, I felt I had been lied about and lied to, and pretty much never wanted to have that experience again.
Right. Well,
Tracy Kidder, does what Jack is saying match your experience?
Well, to some degree. For me, I had already been sort of told that I should be against this war before I went there. And, you know, I was, my men and I were very close to it. We were never more than a couple of miles away from some, you know, terrible mayhem. But we were never right in it. And there was that odd sort of distance between us. But sometimes you'd get a little glimpse of what this really meant. Just how cynically this war was being was proceeding. We rarely talked about the war itself, but every so often you'd hear about a village being bombed upon by mistake, or you'd see a bunch of bodies dumped out of a helicopter to be examined, or I don't know. The whole thing seemed so vulgar to me and so mindless in many ways. And it's funny, I've never been able to figure out why we fought that war, you know. And as I understand it, we still don't know how many Vietnamese were killed. It in some ways reminds me of what's going on right now, but that's another matter.
Jack, thanks for the call. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point. One of the things that comes through in your book, Tracy Kidder, is that it seemed a lot of times you were forming your opinions and presenting yourself for anti-war friends at home. I mean, in your own mind, they were the judges of of what you were doing.
And, of course, the great advantage that I had was that I was able to I was their only source of information about what I was up to. And I kind of, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the old question, what did you do in the war, Daddy? Well, what I'd have to say to my grandchildren would be, well, nothing very dramatic, but I made up some pretty good stuff. You know, I made up some Vietnamese kids that I was befriending. You know, my letters home, I'd insinuate that I was in danger, but I never actually mailed a letter claiming that I was in combat, but I tried to suggest a picture of myself as this rugged guy with smudges on his face from sleeping in a foxhole, one hand holding an M16, the other resting protectively on the shoulder of a Vietnamese boy. And at one point, you know, trying to make my girlfriend back home imagine me a warrior who had discovered his true gentleness in war, I invented a couple of Vietnamese boys to befriend. Actually, I wrote in my spare time and mailed an entire children's story for these kids, a 30-page long story to read to Vietnamese children who didn't exist, and even if they had, wouldn't have understood it. So I was in the deep grip of romanticism.
We are speaking with the writer Tracy Kidder this hour. His new memoir is called My Detachment, a coming-of-age story set in the Vietnam War. And you can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm speaking with the writer Tracy Kidder this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, author of, among others, House, Hometown, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and this new book, My Detachment, His Story of the Vietnam War, which is absent heroes and dramatic combat. Does this kind of war story especially speak to you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-TALK. And let's go to Tim, who's calling from Boston. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. My question to you, Tracy, is it does strike me possible that many of your other books and stories about let us praise famous men and women might be a kind of a redemptive thing for the disillusionment and lack of heroes in the Vietnam experience. What do you think of that?
You mean for me personally?
Yes. In other words, that your other books, which are, you know, such wonderful stories about events and episodes and people who are creative. Was that really a kind of a way of absolving yourself of the Vietnam experience where there were no heroes present?
Well, maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know exactly. You know, I tend to think of my life as a writer. It's something I wanted to do long before. I think if it had... If this war had a real effect on the course that it took, I hope at least that it gave me an interest in sticking up for underdogs. I long felt that soldiers were, you know, some of the underdogs of underdogs. I don't know, the redemptive perhaps. I find that I have finally have lived up to some degree to the psychological implications of this title. I feel pretty detached from it, or maybe another way of saying it is that I've forgiven myself for being for my long adolescence.
Tim, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks.
Tracy, this book is so honest, though. Did you have to sort of steel yourself to... I mean, there are things that were almost embarrassing for me to read. Frankly, because I recognize some of myself, my younger self in them. I mean, it's so personal. Was it hard for you to come to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are things in here that still make me wince, but I do find that now that they're out there where they can't ambush me, they have less power. It's sort of hard to come to those things, but I also realized that if this was going to be an interesting book, those were those things that troubled me, you know, in memory, were the ones that I had to concentrate on. I don't want to say that this is a claim that this is a funny book. That would guarantee that nobody would think it was funny.
Yeah,
but war is intrinsically tragic, but people in war are sometimes hilarious. Sometimes they're preposterous. And I, alas, was both.
What can you quickly tell us one of the episodes that you find humorous? You mentioned, for example, the John Wayne movie with the sun setting in the wrong direction, but something more personal.
I think some of those letters that I wrote back, particularly that one about the I think I guess the thing that comes first to mind is that children's story that I wrote for kids who didn't exist and, you know, and who wouldn't have understood it if they had existed. I was trying to leave an impression, you know, of a sort of person who I thought I might be. I'm sort of struggling with this.
Don't struggle.
Sorry,
but
let me
ask you. You explicitly say at some point early in the book that you did not keep a journal, and yet your memories seem so crisp. Are they, or at least up until the point that you wrote this book, were they that colorful and detailed in your mind?
No, I did have this novel, this inflated novel, which is full of analogs to my own experience, but is about an infantry platoon leader who, you know, has a very dramatically bad time, and whose experiences are very different from mine. He gets shot to death, for instance, and that I think a psychiatrist might consider to be a journal of sorts. I had letters that I had written and hadn't mailed, and for some reason I saved. Had some letters that my mother saved that I'd written, and I had some documents that all sort of thrown together in one big pile that I later rescued. So I was able to verify certain things, but what this book is really true to my memories. It is named, after all, memoir. Memoir to me is a very interesting form. It's named for the most plastic of our human faculties, and it occupies an interesting position somewhere between fiction and nonfiction. That is, when I'm writing nonfiction, I call it nonfiction. I want to verify every fact I possibly can. I don't say that I haven't made mistakes, but in this case, I tried to make it absolutely true to my memory. But that, I found that as those things that bothered me most, you know, that would those kinds of memories that sneak up on you and make you want to put your head underneath a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
I concentrated on those, and I thought my way back and to a large degree, you know, I got these stories right, and I could feel like I was right there, 23 years old again. It's kind of it isn't an entirely comfortable experience, but it was interesting, I guess. I mean, you know, things like I remember thinking back and making up a story. Oh, this is before I joined the Army, to try to impress my girlfriend to say that I was whom I hadn't seen in some time, and to say that I was to insinuate that I was a worldly man, now making up a story that I'd had a venereal disease. I mean,
yes,
as though this would impress her, you know. I mean, really.
And she had the grace to just sort of say nothing at that point, as I recall.
Yeah, she was very, she had a lot of grace, always.
Let's hear from Sean. Sean is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello, Sean.
Hey,
what's on your mind?
Well, you know, this is probably a different question, and I certainly don't want to get into anything too deep, but I spent 6 months in Iraq, and I guess my question is, by listening to you, the similarities from, you know, how you felt, how you reacted, the stories that were larger than they were, I guess. What was what was your personality change coming back from Vietnam in reference to Iraq? And again, I don't know if you have, if you know anything about the military that come back from Iraq. I was just wondering, you know.
Well, I don't, you know, I haven't been to Iraq, and I don't, and I would never presume to try to talk about what it's like there. I do imagine that some things are always never change in the war. You know, Hemingway had a great story about called Soldier's Home, coming back from World War I and dealing with the inflated stories there. For me, after I finally left the Army, I think I realized that I was going to have to not exactly start all over again, but I had to shed some of my stupider notions, my romantic notions. I was disillusioned, I suppose. I was upset about this war. I no longer could feel quite so sanguine about everything that my government did. And I also felt I had to build a new life, you know, a life that was based on something besides fabricated stories. And perhaps, you know, I turned to being a writer. I'd wanted to be a writer long before I'd gone into the military. It seemed to, and part of the reason perhaps that I went in the military was that this is something that a lot of writers had done. Once I left the Army, though, I wanted to be a writer was that I didn't want to have a boss again.
If you'd like to join this conversation, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is calling from Wakefield, Rhode Island.
Tracy, I've read your book, and I can't say that I enjoyed it. I did find it very, very interesting, and I should tell you up front that I was a career Army officer for 24 years, and happily I made my mistakes as a second lieutenant in Germany, where you had to make yours as a second lieutenant in a combat zone, and I certainly do appreciate that. When I reached Vietnam, I was a captain, and I was a military police officer, and that experience, as I read your book, prompted me to think that you're guilty of a hasty generalization in many, many places in the book when you suggest that the experience that you had was shared by most of the 3 million people who, I think, as you say, dressed as soldiers in Vietnam. You suggest that your experience was shared by them, except for the rifleman and the infantry platoon leader and those who earned the combat infantry badge. And I think that was one of the things that I found distressing about the book. I understand it's a memoir. I understand it's called My Detachment. I appreciate the memoir form. But I think you even from the distance of so many years, you make a mistake in that regard. I wondered what you thought about that.
Well,
thanks, Bob.
I'm sorry that you read it that way. That certainly wasn't what I didn't intend to say that my experience was the only experience that other people had in Vietnam, including, you know, other people who weren't directly in combat. I'm a little puzzled, but if it did seem to you that way, then I probably made some just mistakes in the tone of this. I know it's true that most of the people who went to Vietnam were not in combat. I know that some of the people who were not in combat had very rough and difficult jobs, and they were very different from mine. But I don't for a moment want to suggest that everybody else had an experience like mine, or that everyone who came home from Vietnam exaggerated what they'd done there.
Well, one of the things you say directly in the book is that, well, actually, I'm paraphrasing, but you suggest that if you didn't earn the combat infantry badge, you really hadn't had that terrible experience that combat infantry have. And I'm thinking of signal officers and signalmen. Enlisted people who are...
Or artillery forward observers or pilots and helicopter pilots and so on and so forth. But I didn't say... what I said was only a handful came back with this certain proof of a terrible experience. I probably should have phrased that differently. It's very hard. I tried to do this, and I finally just couldn't, you know, to get an exact percentage of those who had been in what most people would call combat and those who hadn't been, but it's, you know, it's hard to get to settle on a firm definition. So I was using the combat infantryman's badge as a way of saying, well, this one subset of people who were in combat was, you're probably right, it probably wasn't clear enough, but I know for sure that most people weren't in combat.
Bob, thanks for the call. I'm Sheila Cast, and this is On Point. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Tracy Kidder, tell us about what, to me, in a way, was sort of the saddest point of the book, was the visit by Major Great.
Well, you know, my men and I had we got visited a lot and inspected a lot. And it was always a bit trying. But we had worked out a system for doing it. I think some general was probably due to come and visit us or possibly come. So before that happened, you'd have a lot of other visitors to make sure that that your commanders didn't get embarrassed when the really big cheese came. And he came and he didn't like what he saw. Perhaps he was right, you know, but at the time he seemed like a terrible villain. The thing was that I sort of crumbled in front of him and in front of my men. And it was, in my memory, actually, it's about the worst thing that I remember. It's, you know, it hardly rises to the level of something dramatic, but it was, in my mind, a big thing.
Why was it such a big thing?
Because I had begun to build that image of myself as a strong young lieutenant sticking up for his men, and after this guy came and gave us these orders, it was sort of running around trying to, you know, do a whole lot of sort of ridiculous work, in a panic, and I forget exactly how I wrote about it, but I said something about that I thought that I was getting closer to that image of myself, and I could this stalwart young lieutenant and I could feel the two of us parting ways.
And did that, was that the attitude that you had toward yourself when you came back? I mean, was that sort of the last, your last memory of Vietnam was being disappointed in yourself?
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed in myself and tired of the whole thing. And yeah.
Do you think you've made peace with that young lieutenant?
I hope so. Yeah, I think I have. Yes, I do. I have. I mean, I'm 59 years old. It was many, many years ago. And, I accept him. I think at the very end of the book, one realizes that I'm no longer asserting that he and I are different people.
Was it important that this story be told in Vietnam? I mean, is Vietnam an important part of the story that it has?
I think so. I mean, I think that the particulars of a story are always really important. God is in the details. And I haven't been to any other wars, so I can't say whether it would have been the same in another war, although I suspect that some things are universal to all wars.
We have been speaking this hour with Tracy Kidder, Pulitzer Prize-winning author who has turned the lens on himself to write a new memoir, My Detachment. Thank you so much for talking with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Sheila Cast. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.